An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to repeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Koo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about, as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Very grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
Her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either, or any other form of tax for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the new deal, if income from the Crown estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge. I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only 2 palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akishino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favor of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's pension for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defense. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown, what it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. No, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger, never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world, perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question, and that question is about the kiswa, the curtain which is upon the house of God, the Kaaba. So this question is about how did this, start? Where did this start from? And, why is it black? And, what's the significance of it? And these kind of things. So in order to answer this question, we needed to take a step back and look at, look at the history behind this. And Ibn Ishaq, he says that in the era of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, there was a white cloth, which covered the Kaaba, which had been woven in Misr, it was woven by the Coptics, and after this, following this, Yemeni cloths were used for it. And then following the death of the Prophet, the subsequent rulers, caliphs, they covered the Kaaba with a Coptic cloth, they used this for covering the Kaaba. The sultans of Egypt, every year they would send two cloths, one for the Kaaba, which was red in color, and another for the grave of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which was green in color, and they would send these for every year to Mecca and to the Hijaz for these purposes. From the year 1221 to 1229, so approximately 8 years. No covering came from Egypt, and the people of the Hijaz, they would themselves cover the Kaaba in a cloth. One of the cloths, the first cloths that was silk, and it was red. The first silk cloth, let's put it this way, was red in color, and then later on it was changed to the color black. And in the season of Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, the people of the Hijaz would, as the season of the Hajj grew closer, they would raise the kiswa slowly. And then finally take it off, and then recover the Kaaba with a white cloth, and then when the season of Hajj was finished, they would bring a new cloth and cover the Kaaba with it. After Islam, different people, different individuals, there's Muawiyah, Yazid, Ibn Zubayr, Hajjaj, the Abbasi caliphs, all of these people, they would cover the Kaaba with a green cloth, sometimes with a red cloth, sometimes with various numerous cloths. And this is some of the history regarding the Kiswa of the Kaaba. There's more, inshallah. We don't have time to complete this discussion. Perhaps we will in further sessions. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has strongly denounced new Israeli plans to build more settlements in the occupied Palestinian lands, stressing that such criminal policies were the direct result of the United States' unconditional support for the Tel Aviv regime. We now present you an article written by Sahar Salhi under the heading, "Every House Belongs to Its Owner and Will Eventually Return to Its Owner." News has circulated about the Zionist regime's new prime minister, Yair Lapid, staying in the occupied villa of a Palestinian businessman from the city of Al-Quds. Yair Lapid's wife also published a picture on social media networks after moving to the new residence, although it is said that this is a temporary stay and will be until the completion of the renovation of her official residence on Balfour Street. In early July, Yair Lapid, the then interim prime minister of the occupying regime, and his wife Lihi moved to an old and beautiful house in Al-Quds called Hana Salame Villa, which abandoned by its owners during the Nakba Day, a move that shows his view of the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis and the violation of the rights of Palestinians, especially their right to return to their homeland. Nakba Day is the name that Palestinians have given to the massacre and forced expulsion of their people by the Zionist regime in 1948, during which they were forced to leave their homes. Salama Villa, which is located on Balfour Street, Talbiya neighborhood, is one of the beautiful villas that was constructed in the 1930s in Palestine with Art Deco style. There is still a sign in three languages at the entrance and in front of the building, which shows the history of the building construction in 1932, and the name of the designer and architect, Zoltán Hamet. Zoltán Hamet was originally a Jewish-Hungarian architect who went to Palestine and started working there a year after graduating from the Faculty of Architecture at Budapest University in Hungary. Owner of this villa, Hana Salame, was an Arab Christian merchant who owned the General Motors dealership in Jordan and in Palestine before the Nakba and built it in the western part of the city of Al-Quds in 1932. After the Nakba and the occupation and bombing of Palestinian neighborhoods in the western areas of Al-Quds, especially the neighborhood of Katamon and Talbiya, Hanna Salama left her villa and became a refugee in Beirut, and the occupying Israeli regime seized the villa by force under the absentee's property law. The law allows the theft of the property of Palestinian refugees and gives the property since the time of its confiscation to Israelis, who are called the guardian of absentee's property. The absentee's property law also allows the Israeli occupation regime to confiscate Palestinian assets, including cash, stocks, furniture, books, companies, banks, and other alienable assets. The main owners of these properties are mostly refugees from other countries, but some of them are internally displaced and now live in their occupied Palestinian lands. After the villa was subjected to usurpation law, it was occupied and taken over and was used by the occupying regime and leased out to foreign countries. For a while, the villa was used to accommodate Israeli soldiers and marines, and for some time it was the residence of the guards and bodyguards of the US consulate on Agron Street, next to the endowments and the Ma'aman Allah Cemetery. After that, the Guatemalan embassy was located there until 1980, when it left after the approval of the United Al-Quds law by the occupying regime. Then the villa was sold on to an Israeli businessman who added three floors to the building of the villa to convert it into several apartments for rent. And later again, for many years, this building was used for the residence of the guards and security services of the official residence of the occupying regime's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, which is located on Balfour Street near this villa. Two former Israeli prime ministers, David Ben-Gurion and Levi Eshkol, refused to live in Palestinian properties seized under the absentee's property law, making Yair Lapid's decision an oddity in Israeli politics. David Ben-Gurion, the commander of the Haganah gang, who committed ethnic cleansing crimes in Palestine, including the shelling of Palestinian homes in the western neighborhoods of Al-Quds during his premiership, refused to move to live in the very Hanna Salama villa in his presidency. Yair Lapid is considered to be the first prime minister of the Zionist regime to have made this decision, which reveals the black truth about his positions regarding the right of return of the Palestinians and the future of Al-Quds, and clearly shows that he's against this right. Jihad Abu Raya, Palestinian researcher and lawyer in Haifa, says, Yair Lapid's decision is reminiscent of Israel's crimes against Palestinians. After expelling the Palestinians and massacring them in their villages and cities, Israeli regime embarked on seizing their homes, houses, factories, shrines, cemeteries, mosques, etc., and acts not as the guardian of such property, but as a thief and a looter. Recently, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly denounced new Israeli plans to build more illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian lands, stressing that such criminal policies were a direct result of the United States' unconditional support for the Tel Aviv regime. Hamas said in a recent statement that Israel had endorsed plans to seize large swathes of Palestinian land to build 2,000 new settler units near Beit Safafa town in occupied Al-Quds. The statement said, "The settlement expansion in Al-Quds is a crime that reflects the American support for the occupation's projects and exposes the false claims of peace." Hamas further said that the resumption of Israel's settlement activities came against the backdrop of U.S. President Joe Biden's controversial trip to the occupied Palestinian territories and to West Asia, adding, "The timing of this settlement project after U.S. President Biden's visit to the occupied lands reveals once again the size of support and official cover being provided by the U.S. administration for the enemy in its aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites." Elsewhere in the statement, Hamas said that Israel's persistence in expanding illegal settlements reflected the dangerous nature of the Zionist project that is based on Judaizing the Palestinian lands and displacing the Palestinian people. It also described the plan as another desperate and failed attempt to impose a demographic fait accompli and target the Palestinian people's rights and identity. Palestinian media recently quoted the head of the Settlement and War Resistance Commission, Muayyad Sha'ban, as revealing that the Israeli authorities had legalized the Mitzpah Dani settlement outpost east of the West Bank city of Ramallah and endorsed the plan to add 114 new settler units to it. He said that the Israeli regime was planning to seize large pieces of land in the village of Deir Dibwan for settlement expansion activities in the area. Muayyad Sha'ban warned that the Israeli authorities were establishing new settlements, specifically in the eastern part of the occupied city of Al-Quds in the occupied West Bank, close to the Jordan Valley. In recent months, the Zionist regime has been rapidly expanding its illegal settlements in contravention of international laws. On 12th of July, the Norwegian Refugee Council said Israeli authorities had ramped up settlement expansion and demolition activities across the West Bank and eastern Al-Quds in the first 6 months of the current year. Between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in over 250 illegal settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and eastern Al-Quds. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with eastern Al-Quds as its capital. The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014, with Israel's continued illegal settlement expansion emerging as a key sticking point.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hausa Ilmi Afkam. Well, talking about the development of relationship with environment, we compared the situation that we are dealing with today, that our children are so much attached to the fantasy world, to the digital world, and this addiction that they have with the digital world has actually detached them from the environment, and which makes them less able to realize the signs of Allah around them in the environment. So you discussed a few points in the previous episode, and we want you to repeat a few of them and tell us new ways. How do we come out of this digital world? And I mean, you clearly explained this, that we need to take out them from this addiction. So once we cannot, I as a mother cannot just tell my child, just give me back the phone, I won't let you play more. I have to provide an alternative. What are those alternatives as per you?
One thing that is very important for us to understand, that we must ourselves understand, that there's no doubt about it. Then when we are talking about the digital world, and we're talking about, for example, the mobile applications and the games, and when we're talking about the mobile itself, the cell phone, it is no doubt, there's no doubt about it, that this technology has been developed by man, by mankind. It is the advancement of the very basic fundamental issues that we believe about in. When we say, when we talk about Allah Almighty, and there's an expression in the Quran that on the Day of Judgment, or generally speaking, the whole of the universe, matwiyatum biyamineh.
Okay.
The Quran says the whole of the universe is in his grip of power.
All right.
Is within his clutches. Everything can come down to this. Everything is in his clutches. He controls everything.
Yes.
This mobile set, when you put it in the palm of your hand,
yeah,
it's a manifestation of that superior intellectual intellect that is controlling all of this.
Yeah.
And he is the creator of everything. And he has created the human being. Who has created this? Which is a manifestation of the signs of Allah Almighty.
Okay, so even if you're giving your children just to play games for a few hours, you can again manifest the signs of Allah.
You can tell them, tell him or tell her, your child, look, what you are doing, it is what the human being has done. But
yeah,
the human being has done something what God has done.
Yeah.
God has created us and all what we do.
Yes.
He is the true creator.
Yeah.
So we have to take him back to that. Now, we need him to, instead of saying, oh, look, you're going to play with this, why don't you break it up and make it again?
Yes.
I mean to say that let us inculcate in our children the habit of breaking things up. Of course, I'm not talking about the mobile that is costing maybe so many millions of tumans or whatever.
Yeah.
Or many, many dollars. Even old things, allow your child to play with them. Open them up.
Okay.
Understand what's there. I mean, even in this world of technology, there are so many gadgets, old things in our house.
So you have to actually push them when they are indulged in this digital world. Just wake up. There's a real world as well. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the importance and ways to detach your children from the digital world and engage them in the environment to develop a relationship with the environment.
Exactly. Yes, we, as I said, we want to divert their attention from this fantasy world. We need to give them an outlet.
We need to
gradually, gently make them think of the essence of these things.
Okay.
I mean, you make them realize that you're engaged in using this technology. Why don't you build it? Why don't you make it? People like you have done it.
Yeah.
Just recently I was visiting a friend of mine, and I saw that in his garage, in the parking, he had allowed his children to old bicycles, even motorcycles. They had broken, torn them apart, disassembled them.
Okay.
And they were assembling them again. And they were changing the fuel from petrol to electricity, putting a battery.
Okay.
I mean, he was allowing his small children
to work, be constructive.
To become, yes, to learn how to make things,
yes.
To develop things.
Yeah.
Developing their technological skills. So through these, we need to provide them opportunities. For example, there's an application you can, Sky Map.
Yeah.
Look at the stars in it. And then take the child out into the night sky and try to find the various constellations that are there.
Yeah.
You have to engage with your child. You can't just leave him at the mercy of it.
Yeah.
But you can. You have to work with him or
to
her.
To supervise,
to help, to assist,
to
facilitate,
analyze.
To channelize in the right direction. Even from this, we can make a better solution, find a better solution through this very engagement that the child is. The problem is with us because we want us ourselves to be
free,
and relieved of the stress and burden of managing a child.
Parenting.
That is our problem, and that is what's happening.
And child, we have to remember, is amana, is a trust from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we cannot just leave him on the mercy of this mobile phone.
Exactly. So we need to help him construct his. We need to help him in constructing in his cognitive abilities. We need to make him understand and develop his mental level.
Yeah.
Intellectual level, cognition. Yeah. We need to help him. Control his feelings and emotions, and we need him to develop his skills.
And even if he's using even if he's involved in the digital world, we need to teach him how to control, how to analyze things, how to be constructive.
I mean, nowadays there are so many programs, applications. Teach your child mathematics. Your child, for example, science. You can divert his attention to
languages. Yeah, we can talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood, so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Naqvi with us, and we're discussing about the ways to develop relationship with the environment. As you mentioned in the previous episodes, I liked those things that you said. Provide alternatives to your children. Something could be trekking, going out for gardening. Do we have some more examples like that? What else we can teach our children to get detached from this digital world and live a more in a real world and develop a better relationship with the environment, explore more in the environment?
Number one, I think we should get our child engaged in helping in at home.
Yeah.
Developing skills to manage the home. Ask him or her to help you make food, iron the clothes, wash the clothes, wash dishes. I mean, engagement in physical activities.
True.
And number two, giving him or her the opportunity to experience creativity and technological skills, taking them the children out into the wild, into nature.
Yeah.
And more than that, I think we need to provide short courses or some non-formal education in the form of group visits.
Yeah.
Taking our children on, not ourselves, he or she should be able to learn how to live in a community, how to engage and interact with other children for sports activities, for learning activities, discovering nature, going out. And for example, I remember once when I was a child, my school took me out for outings.
Okay.
Unfortunately, in the third world countries, that's not possible.
True.
But school in the West and many other organizations like scouting, they used to take children out on trips, on visits, on sports events, collective activities, engaging with other people. Even that would teach us how to live in a community.
Yeah.
There are so many things which have to be done and to be developed in our societies where we can make our children active, make our children engaged with each other. Nowadays, the situation is so bad. Two siblings sitting together. One has taken the mobile phone of his father. The other is taken the mobile phone of his mother.
They're engaged in their own world. Parents are engaged in their own world.
So that is the problem. We have to create events. We have to manage, come down together as parents to think over how to manage these things. In a family, you have brothers and sisters who are married. You have families. Work together and how to develop events and programs to get our children to
involved in the environmental activities. Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. We came to the conclusion that you need to, even if you want to detach your children from the digital world, you definitely need to provide an alternative, especially the environmental ones. You can take out them for trekking, you can take out them for camping, you can take out them to jungles, for outings, to explore nature, to research more. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says four times in Quran, why don't you go for tadabbur? Why don't you contemplate? Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. That was all for today. Inshallah, until another session, fi amanallah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.